Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
This podcast episode is brought to you by Coors Light. These days, everything is go, go, go. It's nonstop hustle all the time. Work, friends, family expect you to be on 24/7. Well, sometimes you just need to reach for a Coors Light because it's made to chill. Coors Light is cold lagered, cold filtered, and cold packaged. It's as crisp and refreshing as the Colorado Rockies. It is literally made to chill. Coors Light is the one I choose when I need to unwind. So when you want to hit reset, reach for the beer that's made to chill. Get Coors Light in the new look delivered straight to your door with Drizzly or Instacart. Celebrate responsibly. Coors Brewing Company, Golden, Colorado.
Chase Thomas Podcast. The Chase Thomas Podcast. My nephew needs me to record. See, I already hate it.
All right, we're back on a Tuesday edition of the Chase Thomas Podcast. Jonathan Taylor Thomas talks Major League Baseball, Cleveland Indians 2020 review edition, Cleveland Spiders maybe very soon, who knows. John Taylor is here as he always is up there in Brooklyn where all the sports writers, all of them live and reside. John, good afternoon, how are you?
Doing great here in Midtown Brooklyn. Brooklyn, Manhattan.
Brooklyn, Manhattan. It's where all the kids go. People love it. I love that. That cracked me up last week. There is a lot of movement going on in Major League Baseball this week, John. We have the White Sox signing Liam Hendricks. We have Manfred being like, "Go fuck yourself. We're doing 162 games." The Nationals signing Kyle Schwarber. Dodgers re-signing Blake Treinen, like all kinds of nitty gritty. Where do you want to start in our news items today before we get into the Indians?
I mean, Liam Hendricks is the most recent news, and it definitely isn't. I mean, I say it has an impact on Cleveland. Cleveland's own machinations have more of an impact, but I mean, I think Hendricks is notable only because the AL Central now at this point really is a two-team race between Chicago and Minnesota, and I have to imagine that by signing Hendricks, the White Sox have the upper hand right now, if only because especially the Twins haven't done anything yet, aside from sign Hansel Robles, which we're not going to count as anything. So, you know, it's interesting what the White Sox have done in that they've only made three moves in signing Hendricks and Adam Eaton and trading for Lance Lynn, but Lynn and Hendricks alone are just two really high-impact moves. Again, especially in a division where no one else is really doing anything right now. And there's also the idea, too, that if you're going to splurge on a reliever, you might as well do it for one of the best out there. And Hendricks is definitely that guy. Big strikeout numbers, big stuff. The main concern I have with Hendricks, beyond obviously the fact that you're going to be paying him $18 million a year for the next 4 years in one capacity, or $13 million a year for the next 3 years, and then $15 million in his fourth year one way or the other, because of that interesting contract he signed where the fourth year is either a team option worth $15 million or a buyout worth $15 million in deferrals. I mean, beyond that, I mean, just expending that kind of money on a reliever, then giving that reliever to Tony La Russa, that doesn't feel like the best strategy to me. You're basically just asking La Russa to turn his arm into pulp. If I'm Rick Hahn and I already have to deal with the fact that I have a manager I don't want, I am probably telling La Russa, please be very careful with Liam Hendricks. You know, you're not using him back-to-back. You're not using him two innings at a time, whatever it is, which, I mean, kind of probably limits his value. But again, with La Russa, you probably do have to throw some brakes on things, because left to his own devices, especially at the age of 76, I really don't imagine he's – and the thing, we don't know what Tony La Russa's managerial style is like at this point. He hasn't managed since, what, 2010, somewhere around there? How long has it been since Tony La Russa was a major league manager? Like a decade now at this point?
At least.
We don't know what his managerial style is going to look like when it comes to pitcher decisions, bullpen management, any of that stuff. My assumption is it's going to be miserable. So that's the only concern I have with Hendricks, is do you really want to put Liam Hendricks in the hands of Tony La Russa? But at the same time, I guess you'd rather put Liam Hendricks in his hands than a worse reliever. You know, is it really going to be any better if you do that with, you know, who's even left at this point? I guess if they were to work out a trade for Brad Hand,
yeah.
Or someone.
Well, Brad Hand's a free agent.
Oh, that's right, because we went through it. I still don't understand why no one picked up Brad Hand for a year and $10 million when Liam Hendricks is going for $18 million. That to me remains the weirdest move of this offseason, that Cleveland was more or less like, anyone who wants can have a free Brad Hand, and 29 other teams went, eh, no thanks. That's very odd to me. I mean, we're in an offseason. Yeah, he's not that old. I guess Archie Bradley would be the other best free agent reliever available right now. And both of those guys are clearly a tier down from Hendricks anyway. I mean, Hendricks is probably one of the 10 best relievers in baseball right now. So it's obviously a good move for Chicago, just on the surface, on paper, whatever you want to call it. It probably makes them the slight favorite over Minnesota right now, but that division is neck and neck between those two. And it kind of it's what we were talking about, I think, last week, too. I forget exactly why. But that idea of every win at a certain level being worth way more than it usually is because of, you know, the fact that these wins, any extra wins Chicago can pick up this offseason, are the difference between winning the division and being a wild card team. And Hendricks is definitely a move toward winning the division. So this has been a really weird offseason. Not weird, but I guess not all that unexpected, but just the fact that there's still so many major free agents unsigned, and it is January 12th. We are roughly 1 month away from pitchers and catchers, assuming pitchers and catchers happens normally this year, which, given the way things are going with the NBA and in the country at large, I kind of doubt that's going to be the case. But regardless, good for Chicago, good for Liam Hendricks. Definitely now the onus is on Minnesota to do something to counter. Like we said last week when we were talking about the Twins, I think obviously it starts with re-signing Nelson Cruz. But I don't know. I'll be interested to see, like, once the offseason wraps up, kind of who the consensus favorite is for the AL Central, because I think it's going to be really close between those two teams.
I am operating on the assumption that it's the Twins until the White Sox prove it. Like, it's one of those where I want to see it, and I want to see how this all looks with La Russa in this group. I'm not penciling them in as a favorite. I think you have to include everything.
La Russa really is a very big potential negative X factor.
Yes.
Yeah, it's going to be really interesting to see what comes of that.
Do you think if you had just, like, they had hired, I don't know, who is a good alternative? Like, the White Sox hired Ron Washington as their new manager instead. Do you?
I would have loved Wash.
Well, what I'm saying is, like, would you view the White Sox offseason through a different lens? Would you be far more stoked? Would we be looking at this team like, oh, yeah, nailed it. Perfect offseason. They should be the favorite.
Yeah, I would feel better about the White Sox if they hired a manager who wasn't an old drunk, for sure. Like, that's kind of the thing. Like, for as much good as the White Sox have done this offseason, for as good as that roster is, they're putting it in the hands of someone who it should not be in the hands of. Just flat out point blank. Like, Tony La Russa should not be a manager in today's game. He's only there because Jerry Reinsdorf is his best buddy. Like, yeah, I would feel a lot better about the White Sox if Tony La Russa were nowhere near that roster. And I really like, this is one of the things like, oh, it can't be that bad. No, I really don't think anything positive is going to come out of this. I think he's going to be an absolute flat out disaster. So,
yeah, I don't know. Rob Manfred planning for a 162 game season. John, do you see spring training starting? Because we already know the minors have been pushed back. Are you a believer that they're going to agree to a 162 game season? Because ultimately, it seems like the players want that more than the owners, right? Which is kind of strange because he's working for the owners. And I'm just surprised he's coming out with that.
I was surprised by that too, because when Manfred said that, my mindset was, I thought the owners wanted a shorter season.
Right,
Because they want fans in the stands and they want another prorated salary season. I don't think they're going to get to 162 games regardless of who wants it. I just think that with the way COVID is currently just tearing through the country, it's just not going to happen. I don't see any way it happens. Like, we're already seeing the NBA is just getting torn apart by it. And the NBA is obviously has much smaller rosters, which both help and hurt, because obviously the spread is theoretically smaller, but also, you know, smaller rosters means that, you know, two guys go down and all of a sudden you're in real fucking trouble. So
can I give you my conspiracy theory about the pro sports situation in 2021?
Yes.
There's this part of me when I'm seeing the different stuff and I'm hearing that they're not going to jump the line and that they went publicly about not jumping the line a few weeks back with the COVID vaccines, that with it getting out of control, they're going to be like, the owners are going to come out and be like, we just got to do it. Where fans are like, just do it. Like, turn the impetus to the fans to be like, okay, y'all can jump the line. We need our sports, and like, the Sixers playing with 8 players is really depressing and awful. Just jump the line. We'll move on. We'll jump the line. Like, to wait for the public sentiment to change of just being like, yeah, no, you can go do it. We're cool with it now. Because I think we're nearing the point where it's like, yeah, they're just all going to be like, we were going to do it anyway, but we want to make sure that we didn't put together a strong revolt by vaccinating everybody too quickly.
Maybe, I don't know. I mean, I just don't think, regardless of how this works, vaccines or not, I just don't think there's enough time at this point to get a 162 game season off the ground, because the vaccine is not going to be, even if MLB manages to jump to the front of the line, given how slow this rollout has been and how badly it's been handled, I don't see how everything gets set in time for a regular spring training. And I do think that regardless of Manfred saying, I want a full season, you're going to have owners come out and say, maybe not all of them, but probably a sizable contingent and a loud contingent say, no, we want to wait till fans can go to games, because otherwise we're going to take another bath on revenues, which, not true. But regardless, that's going to be the line that they want to hold, is we want fans to come back to games. We do not want to play games until that's possible. Especially because there are going to be some teams that can play games with fans in states that have just given up entirely. But, you know, how is it going to, like, if the season starts and, you know, fans in Tampa can go to games, the fans in New York City can't, how long is it going to be before Rob Manfred has Randy Levine in his ear screaming about how this is completely unfair, he's losing money, but the Rays aren't, or whatever it is? That's why I just think the 162 game season just probably isn't going to happen anyway, because there are just too many logistical complexities and the fact that the owners are just going to be flat out against it. So, I mean, and to be fair, I think Manfred is saying we're going to have under 162 game season, not because he necessarily believes that that's the case, but because he needs to present a veneer of normalcy to make it seem like everything is going normally. You know, baseball, he needs to position the sport as going back to normal. That's a huge part of everything right now. Things are going back to normal. We're going to have a full season. We're going to, you know, we're going to play with fans in the stands, all that fun stuff. You know, that has to be the message, because otherwise people are just going to, I don't think people necessarily tune out, but you have to sell an idea of normalcy, I think. And that's what Manfred is trying to do, because he's, you know, he's not just responsible to the owners. He also has to, you know, promote and protect the image of Major League Baseball. And I think in that regard, that means full season, regular season, etc.
Yeah, we'll see what happens here. The Nationals break the internet. They sign Kyle Schwarber. I really wanted Kyle Schwarber if the DH was going to be a thing in the NL this year. But, yeah, the Nationals. Get another one. Gearing up for the Chicago Cubs send-off before they trade for Chris Bryant in a couple weeks.
I mean, Kyle Schwarber could still be a DH, assuming that, you know, the NL brings back the DH at some point, or keeps the DH.
Well, it's
rather.
A one-year deal, right? Like, so I don't think.
If they bring back the DH for 2021, it makes all the sense in the world for him to be a DH as opposed to a terrible left fielder. It's a move that Washington had to make. They need another bat. They need an outfielder. Kyle Schwarber can do both of those things. It's a reasonable contract at just $10 million. It makes sense for both sides. If you're a Nationals fan, maybe you want to see something a little more impactful than Kyle Schwarber and Josh Bell as your two major offseason additions. I don't know that the Nats are going to end up doing more than that, though. I mean, I think from this point forward, it's probably filling out the roster with on similar one-year deals for kind of more established guys. I mean, I don't think they were ever going to be involved in the chase for guys like George Springer and JT Realmuto, even though you could argue that they really should have been. But I mean, if you're gonna play in the kind of middle section of free agency, you could do a lot worse than Schwarber. The trick is going to be obviously just figuring out whether or not he's capable enough defensively to hold that role down. And also, I mean, I'm curious now. Like, this is the Nationals did have an internal option in left field in Andrew Stevenson, who has gotten very little playing time over the last 2 years, but has hit very well the last two seasons when he has played. So I'm kind of curious what they're going to do with him, because both he and Schwarber are left-handed hitters, so you can't platoon them. I don't know. I would have been interested to see what they could have gotten out of Stevenson, but Schwarber is definitely a good addition to have, or a good addition to make. So it makes sense for both sides. He gets a year to try to re-up his value and try to score a long-term deal. And the Nationals get a hitter because they really needed a hitter. Their lineup is not great.
Yeah. But, hey, at least the Nationals are doing stuff. Shout out to the Nationals. Keep doing stuff.
The other thing I will mention is Schwarber is a guy who desperately needs a platoon partner, which I don't really know that the Nationals have for him right now. That's why I was saying with Stevenson, like, you know, in an ideal world, Stevenson is a right-handed hitter who you can throw in there against lefties, but as it stands right now, like, that's not the case. So if you're the Nationals, who are you? I mean, it's not the biggest concern in the world is who do you platoon with Kyle Schwarber, but they don't really have any good options there unless they want to try Jake Knoll in the outfield, which they should not do that.
No. The Dodgers re-signed Blake Treinen to a two-year deal. Do you like this for the Dodgers?
Sure. He was good for them last year. He should be good for them again, assuming he's healthy. I mean, the thing with Treinen that's curious is his velocity has been slipping a little bit. He doesn't throw that same, like, power sinker that he used to. His velocity has gone from 98 when he was on the A's just to 97 this year. I mean, which is not, like, a huge dip or anything. It's just a question of can he stay healthy? And, well, that's pretty much it. I think for the Dodgers it makes sense to just lock in as many like high tier relief arms as you can, given the way Kenley Jansen has slipped and given that you can really never have too many good relievers. So I think it makes sense for them. It makes perfect sense for them to keep him around because that's the other thing. Like, otherwise they'd be getting a reliever unless they were going to get Liam Hendricks, which I know they were kind of connected to him, but I don't think they ended up. I don't think they obviously they ended up getting him, and I don't know how serious that was, but they, you know, unless they were going to sign Liam Hendricks, like all the other relievers a la Treinen were pretty much in his same class, like Bradley, Hands, Trevor May before he signed with the Mets. So, I mean, really, if you're not going to sign Treinen, who else are you going to sign who's really any appreciably better? And it would have been Hendricks. And so if they're not going to get Hendricks, Treinen is pretty much the next best thing.
Yeah. Well, the Dodgers, good to see some good things going their way. I like it. Who doesn't want to see it? Now, we've been saving the biggest Major League Baseball story of the last week. I didn't want to include the Lindor stuff in the news and notes part of this podcast because it's part of the Indians who we'll be talking about now. The Francisco Lindor trade. I don't even know if it's worth asking, did the Cleveland Indians get enough for Francisco Lindor from the New York Mets?
Depends what you mean by enough. Did they get, I mean, what they got was two relatively cheap, in the case of Andrés Giménez, like just, you know, first 3 years of his contract, like major league minimum cheap, middle infielders, which they needed. And they got a pair of prospects who cost them nothing right now and will continue to cost them nothing for a good long while. So in that sense, the Indians got exactly what they wanted. Four controllable guys who will be around for a bit and who, in the case of Giménez and Ahmed Rosario, will be fine. Did they get as much as you would have expected for the combination of Francisco Lindor and Carlos Carrasco? Absolutely not. Is it a light return? Yeah. Yeah, it is. Does it make Cleveland better for 2021? No, it clearly makes them worse. Does it make them better for the future? Not as much as re-signing Francisco Lindor and keeping Carlos Carrasco would have been. So, no, I wouldn't say they got enough, if only because what they got is just, again, two cheap middle infielders and a couple of prospects who may help down the road. It's selling low, which is crazy to think about. It's selling low on one of the five best shortstops in baseball and Carlos Carrasco on top of it. The Carlos Carrasco part is the thing that really just kind of makes this feel all the much worse for Cleveland. It's one thing to give up Lindor for a light package. It's another thing to throw Carrasco in there just to get rid of more money while you can. Because that's what really makes it obvious. This is just about, like, the Yu Darvish trade is really just about getting rid of money. And in exchange, again, all they're getting is Ahmed Rosario and Andrés Giménez. That's it. That's not a lot. That's two pretty mediocre middle infielders right now.
Like, let's also mention they didn't have to do this. And this is something that I've seen national baseball writers that I like and respect overlook, is that, well, let's start here. It's like you have to have this preface that they didn't have to do this, and the Cleveland Indians were one game away from winning the AL Central last year. Like, there is no incentive to do this other than we want to save money. Like, that is the only incentive, and that is something that I think just has to be hammered home. It's just like there is no reason for the Cleveland Indians to trade their best player in his prime. There's just none.
No, and The only excuse you can make is that Cleveland knew they would not be able to re-sign Lindor. But again, like you said, that is a decision of the team's own making. That is ownership deciding in advance whatever Lindor costs, which is almost certainly going to be an extension worth $250 million or more, is not something that we want to spend. There's not an amount of money we want to spend. And that's a decision on the part of Paul Dolan, because he can afford that. The Indians can afford, the Cleveland can afford that. I know that Cleveland is a small market. They never run big payrolls, blah, 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 blah. Enough of that. They can afford what they want to afford. Every team in baseball can afford what it wants to afford. It is all a choice. All of this is a choice. And I feel like I've said that a million times, both here and elsewhere, but payroll is a choice. There is nothing stopping Cleveland from spending more money. There is only the admission on the team's part that they don't want to spend more money, that keeping this player is not cost effective enough for them. Therefore, they will be getting rid of this player in exchange for other players who are more cost effective. And that if that means that the 2021 Indians win 79 games and finish in third place, well, that's the unfortunate reality, you know? And that's kind of, I know we've talked about this too, is like, that is the central problem with baseball right now, is that what happens on the field is not as important as what happens financially. It is more important to the majority of team owners and front offices and teams generally how much they are spending on the team than whether or not the team is actually any good. Because again, there isn't any justification you can make for trading Francisco Lindor. Or better said, you can't make any argument that trading Francisco Lindor makes Cleveland better in 2021. There's no argument. None whatsoever. Zero. None. It makes them worse. It makes them worse in 2021. It makes them worse in 2022. And so on and so on and so on. Unless one or both of those prospects, and I guess also Andrés Giménez, who is young enough to still be considered a prospect, even though he lost prospect status, turns out to be the next Francisco Lindor. who will then be traded in 6 years' time. Like, that's the other part. It's just an endless cycle of just only being competitive for as long as your good player is affordable. And again, affordable in quotes, for as long as you care to keep paying him. So, yeah, no, it's a choice. It is entirely a choice. And Cleveland fans should be very upset about that, because this is a team that 4 years ago was one win away from a World Series, and that was still very much a contender in a weak division, even with the Twins and White Sox being there too. All Cleveland had to do this offseason was add, and they would have been right up there with Chicago and Minnesota. A rotation that has the AL Cy Young winner and Shane Bieber in it, and that has Francisco Lindor and Carlos Carrasco and Jose Ramirez. Just add stuff. And you don't even have to add that much. They didn't have to go out and get JT or Realmuto and re-sign Trevor and bring back Trevor Bauer and add George Springer. Just get some competent outfielders. Any outfielders, honestly.
Cleveland just re-sign Michael Brantley.
Seriously, re-sign Michael Brantley. Sign Kyle Schwarber. They're mid-tier starters you could sign if you really need them for some reason. Keep Brad Hand for only $10 million.
Go nuts. Take Nick Markakis.
Okay, let's not go that far. That's the thing. Like, Cleveland intentionally made itself worse for 2021 in order to make itself cheaper going forward. That's the only reason they did why they did. And that shouldn't be okay. Not that it shouldn't be allowed, but it is really one of those things where it's like, it just shouldn't be okay. It shouldn't just be accepted that that's how teams operate now. I mean, that's how they have operated, but that just should not be something that we just like, shrug our shoulders and go, well, what are you going to do? At some point, some fan base is going to need to take some level of action with regards to telling teams, enough is enough, build a winner or we're not here anymore. And I don't know how or when that happens, but I have to feel like if you're a Cleveland fan, why are you watching that team next year? What have they done to keep you around? If anything, all they've done is push you away. They took the best player on the team, the face of the franchise, the guy everybody loves, and just got rid of him for nothing, really. Why are you watching next year? What's the point? Why are you giving Cleveland your money, your attention, your time? They don't earn it. They haven't earned it. They don't deserve it. They've just told you that your time is not worth anything to them. That the more important thing is that they don't spend as much as they were previously projected to.
In happier news, Shane Bieber is actually awesome. Is he, like, he's in Cleveland, he's away from the spotlight, but, like, is he going to be maybe, like, the best starting pitcher in the AL for the next several years?
I don't know. I mean, it's tough because, I mean, when we're talking about the best pitcher in the American League over the next years, like, who's the competition there in terms of, and I just to keep it just a limited, because obviously we could talk about guys like Cole or potentially Verlander if when he's healthy, but Bieber turns 26 in May. So if we want to talk about other guys in that same age range, like who is the competition for him? It's probably
Giolito.
Maybe it's Giolito probably. I think Tyler Glasnow is part of that conversation. Is Jose Berríos even still under 26? Also, a guy who's very inconsistent but has the stuff to be up there. Berríos is exactly 26 and turns 27 in May. So it's a pretty short list of guys, I would imagine, who are as young as Bieber is but as talented and have been as productive as he is. So at least within his age range, and maybe you could even say under 30, you know, yeah, you're probably talking about the best pitcher in the American League and the best pitcher in the American League going forward for a few years. What'll be interesting is how replicable is what he did last year going over to next year. And I feel like maybe he's not going to put up like a 281 ERA plus again. That's kind of hard to say the least, but all the peripherals are very, very, I mean, he had a FIP of 207 versus an ERA of 163. He wasn't lucky last year. He earned it. He earned all that success. I don't know. I mean, who would you say would be kind of in his class in terms of other pitchers who were, you know, similar age range who are on that same level of performance?
I mean, I think you're right about Glasnow. I think it's probably him, I don't know. I really look around the league and I'm like, I just feel like Shane Bieber is just going to be the best starting pitcher in the AL, and it doesn't fucking matter because they're not trying in his prime. Like, he's literally just going to be awesome for a team that's literally not trying to make the playoffs anymore. Like, no, for the duration of the rest of his 20s. Like, that is an insane timeline miss up on their part.
And that's a good point on your part, that when you have a pitcher as good as Shane Bieber, you're supposed to build up around him. Because otherwise, like you said, you're just going to waste the next 2 or 3 years of his career before you trade him, too.
Like, what is the point of Shane Bieber on the Indians for the next 3 years? That's what I'm trying to wrap my head around.
The bigger question, I know we're going to get to it at some point. What's the point of Jose Ramirez on Cleveland at this
point? Well, let's just get to that now, because that was my follow-up to this, is that, like, what is the point? They're not trading Shane Bieber. He's cheap and awesome for them for a while, and they can't go that full. Jose Ramirez, though, like, what is the point?
None, as far as I can tell. Well, why are you... Why, like, that's the thing. If you're Cleveland... A Francisco Lindor Carlos Carrasco trade is a teardown. There's really no other way to look at it. You made your team worse. Not just worse, but like worse to a point where you went from playoff contender just out of it completely. That Indians team, or that, this Cleveland team, is probably going to be below 500, maybe 500 at best. So if you're not going to make the playoffs, well, I guess that's the thing. In the expanded format, there's still a chance. But realistically, who cares? If you're just going to, like, I always come back to the Mike Ehrmantraut belief. There are no half measures. You go all in or you don't do it at all. And if you're going to trade Francisco Lindor and Carlos Carrasco, you might as well go all in and finish the damn job. But here's the thing. Jose Ramirez will turn 29 in September. So this will be his age 28.
I feel
season.
Like he's been 35 for 10 years now. I cannot believe he's in his 20s. Like, that still blows
really
my
weird.
Mind.
He's under contract for next year with two, I want to say, entirely reasonable team options for 2022 and 2023. But it's Cleveland we're talking about. Who knows how reasonable that is. Regardless, he's under contract for this year and then two team options totaling $24 million the next 2 years. So he is extremely affordable and extremely under contract. And so I get that sense of Cleveland's like, why would we give him up when he's affordable and productive and when we still have him for two more years and then he just walks and that's the end of it? Or maybe we trade him sometime in 2022 or whatever. I guess the other side of it is like, if you trade, I don't know. Talking about this is just kind of sad because, like, who knows what Cleveland is doing and why if all they care about is shedding money. Right, that's kind of the thing. Like, it just makes it hard to be like, why are you keeping Jose Ramirez? Oh, because he's cheap. And why did you get rid of? But you got rid of Francisco Lindor, so your team's not going to be good. So why do you keep Jose Ramirez anyway? Oh, well, we didn't get much for Francisco Lindor. Oh, because he's a pending free agent. There's just so many complications of, like, I mean, here's the thing, if you put Jose Ramirez on the trade market, he'd bring a lot back because, again, he's only under contract, or not only under contract, he's only owed $24 million past this year. In two very good team options. You know, some very smart contender would probably give up a fair amount for him, a la what the Rays got for Blake Snell. Which then makes me feel like if you're Cleveland, then why don't you do that? If you're gonna start rebuilding, why not turbocharge it and move Ramirez?
Right? Do we know for certain? Like, what do we expect Jose Ramirez Indian for the rest of the season? I don't think so.
No, we don't know for certain. But at the same time, it's like the two most valuable assets. The two best players on your roster, and I guess honestly the two most valuable assets when you consider contract and age, are Shane Bieber and Jose Ramirez. I'm not saying you trade both of them, but if you're going to accept that 2021 is a step back toward better in the future, I mean, I guess therein lies the calculus of, do you think, like, does Cleveland's front office think that within the next 3 years, the last 3 years of Jose Ramirez under contract, that they will be good enough for him to be worth being there, as opposed to trade him for what you can get now and move on from there? And I don't know. Like, I don't know Cleveland's system well enough to know how they feel about oh, hey, well, we can still, do they think this is a skinny rebuild? I mean, clearly, I guess, because they haven't done anything else. You know, do they still feel like their roster is good enough to compete even without Lindor and Carrasco, which I think is insane, but, you know, whatever. I don't know, but I get the feeling that if you're going to make that move, you might as well keep going, right? You might as well. I'm not saying you trade everything that isn't nailed down to the floor, but a guy like Ramirez would actually bring a ton back. And again, like, he's only under contract for the next 3 years. Is Cleveland confident that within those next 3 years it can win a championship? I don't think so. Or at least looking at the roster from the outside, I don't see how that happens.
Yeah, I don't either. But future Brave Jose Ramirez, I am excited about that.
In what universe are the Braves giving up talent for anything?
Well, hold on. They're getting there. It's a plan. It's a process, if you will, John Taylor. Have you had a second to look at the Indians outfield?
This is what cracks me up. Mike Petriello made this point. How do you trade Lindor and Carrasco and not get an outfielder back when you have Cleveland's outfield?
That's
the funniest part of all of this. If they had at least gotten one outfielder back who was of any damn use, then this trade would have looked a little bit better. It still would have been a bad trade, but at least you could have said, well, at least they did.
We got Michael Conforto.
The worst outfield in baseball. Their projected outfield is, I swear to God, Josh Naylor, Bradley Zimmer, and someone named Daniel Johnson. I legit have no idea who Daniel Johnson is.
Mm.
Not a clue. I have never seen that name before. Ever. And it's not like there are better options sitting on the bench. Oscar Mercado, Jordan Luplow.
Franmil Reyes.
Well, big Franmil is going to be the DH almost certainly because he should not
but
be
in the outfield. But he might have to get some fielding in.
And, like, I know they have Bobby Bradley's more of a first baseman. I think they tried him in the outfield, but there's just not – and that's the thing. You look in their system, in their farm system, there's really no one close. Their best outfielder prospect-wise is George Valera. He's 20 years old, and he has not gotten above low A ball. That's not a dude who's going to help anytime soon. The guy they got from the Mets, Isaiah Green, similarly, he's 19 years old. He's going to start the season in low A ball if there is a minor league season at all. There's no help coming internally. So what? You have to do something if you're Cleveland. You have to go get outfielders. This is, again, going to be the worst outfield in baseball. Okay, I will say this. In Daniel Johnson's defense, he is ranked as – or he did rank last year as one of the Indians' top 10 – or as one of Cleveland's top 10 prospects. And according to our own – what's it called? According to our own Eric Longenhagen, he currently ranks 16th on that list. So he's not terrible. But, like, again, this is a guy who – you're really just going to I don't know. It's so bad. It's so bad. Like, when you have to throw Jake Bowers out there, who's, again, Cleveland has a weird collection of first base DH types who really should never be in the outfield. I don't know. That's the thing. Like, and, like, a guy like Daniel Johnson, is he a regular? I mean, reading Eric's blurb on him, it seems like the mindset there is no, he is not. He's probably a platoon bat. That's useful, but, like, I don't understand how this is an area that Cleveland just, like, refuses to do anything about. It's pathological at this point. Why are they not getting more outfielders? Why are they convinced that this is something where Josh Naylor and Bradley Zimmer and Daniel Johnson is an okay trio to run out there every day? It's frankly not. Those are three pretty mediocre hitters. Really doesn't seem like that's what you should be relying on, but clearly Cleveland just does not care. Just doesn't care. And that's the thing, like, with all of this and talking about Cleveland. They don't care. They just clearly do not care about their fans, about 2021, about winning. If winning happens, great. If it doesn't happen, so be it. All that matters is just not spending that much money.
Yeah.
That's all that matters to them. That's the depressing part.
Well, we'll have to end it there, John Taylor. That's how we have to end it with the Cleveland Indians. Hopefully, Cleveland Spiders. What are you pulling for? What name do you want them to be renamed?
I don't really think I've seen a single name that I like all that much. I'm in the minority here. I'm not crazy about the Spiders name.
Oh,
it's just kind of silly.
Well, you can't always be right, John. You can't always be right.
I frequently am not right. But I just, Cleveland Spiders just feels weird to me. I don't know.
Well, it's unfortunate, but sometimes you're wrong, John, and it's okay. John, what can we check out from you this week on the interwebs?
I got nothing going, just still doing some of the editing for Fangraphs. But no, I got nothing coming out on my end.
All right. Well, go follow him at J.A. Taylor. Follow myself at Chase_Thomas. John, thank you as always for the time, good sir. Are we doing Tigers next week?
Oh boy, is there even enough to talk about with the Detroit Tigers?
Yeah. Robbie Grossman in the house. Casey Mize in the house.
Why are you gonna make me chop at the bit
for some Tigers talk?
I'm just looking at their roster now because I'm genuinely curious. Like I don't really know the Tigers particularly well. It's not a team I really pay much attention to. Holy moly, this is depressing.
Oh, the AL Central. It's all depressing. There you go. Well, John, thank you. Talk to you soon.
Sugar Ray Leonard, Roberto Duran, Marvelous Marvin Hagler, and Thomas Hearns. Legends, whose four-way rivalry defined one of the greatest eras in boxing history. Relive their decade of dominance in the new Showtime sports documentary, The Kings, a four-part series premiering Sunday, June 6th, only on Showtime.
The Aaron's AA team makes getting the name brand furniture, electronics, and appliances you need easy and affordable. We're talking top brands like HP, Samsung, GE, Beautyrest, and so many more. Take them home today, then make low monthly payments until they're yours for good. Aaron's great rent-to-own deals even come with easy approvals and free delivery. That's Aaron's, the rent-to-own power of the AA team.
All right.
Hey everyone, I want to tell you about Blue Wire Hustle, a brand new program where you can host your very own podcast here at Blue Wire. Hustle was created to give everyone the opportunity to take your podcast to the next level. Or if you want to host a podcast and just don't know where to start, Hustle is the perfect place for you. As part of the program, you'll receive personal cover art, Q&As with Blue Wire's top podcasters, access to our community Discord, and an e-learning course full of tips and tricks. And on top of that, we'll help get you your show pushed out to Apple, Spotify, Google, Stitcher, and all other listening platforms. And the best part is, you can get all of this for only $15 a month, the same rate as any other hosting site would charge you just for the initial setup. So whether you're starting from scratch or having an existing show that you want to grow, Hustle is an open door to leveling up your sports experience. Acceptance into the program is limited, so get your application in today. To apply, go to bwhustle.com/join. Check out the description box for this episode to find out more, but that's bwhustle.com/join. All right, we're back on the Chase Thomas Podcast, and I am now joined by Impact Wrestling's TJP, or Manic, depending on what you prefer to go by today. What would you prefer, TJ?
Well, right now the monster's not coming out, so it's definitely TJ this morning. But I guess it depends on how many cups of this coffee I have. It might switch. But
what is your average coffee intake per day, TJ?
So if it's coffee, I might have a couple cups in the morning, but usually by the afternoon, I'll switch to something like an energy drink or like a pre-workout or something. And my caffeine intake is way above the recommended cap. So it's probably why Manic came back now in recent years, to be honest. It's too much caffeine.
Well, see, now I'm figuring out why your matches move so quickly now, is that the caffeine intake is up. You have a caffeine spike, and then there you go. Like, I was telling some buddies, because I was doing the year-end awards
and I kind of want to start here, is you've become in-ring one of my favorite workers to watch. And I was watching some old stuff of you from like 8 years ago, and it's just Cody had this thing a few months back where he was like, the wrestler's prime doesn't really start till he reached 35, and you're 36 now, correct?
Yeah, it just turned a couple months ago. Yeah,
well, happy late birthday, sir.
I think that's true.
Is like, it, you can see that you've kind of mastered professional wrestling at this point, where now I'm like, oh, the difference is there. Do you go back and watch your stuff from a decade ago and look at where you are now, and you're like, everything is fluid? And when I describe your style to other people, I'm like, well, his in-ring style is just so crisp. Like, you are the most crisp, fast worker I enjoy watching now. And that's kind of where wrestling has gone. But the transitions from high flying stuff to submission moves, like, it's just, it all looks so clean and it all happens so fast that, like, when I'm taking notes watching these shows, I'm like, I just don't understand how he's able to do that in that amount of time and make it look as easy as he does. Like, you make professional wrestling look easy.
I had a coach once, a boxing coach, who told me, he would always say, make it look easy. And that was like his way of, it was sort of like his, like, credo, I guess. I mean, it was when you would do mitts and things, is just like, because he felt like if people felt more inclined to do things that way, then they would actually fight better. Like, they would be like, the aggressive and like more gamey part of it would come out if you just approached it like a game from the onset. So he would always say, make it look easy, make it look easy. And so stuff like steps and footwork and things like that, always I always remember just hearing him say that a lot with like drilling, because it just, I don't know. And I've always been drawn to people, like, I've always been drawn more to Muhammad Ali than to, you know, Foreman or Tyson, for example. You know, like, I've just always been drawn to guys that are smooth and operate in that way. And you know, some guys, they like Steve Austin. They like the ass kicker. Mm-hmm. You know? And for me, I've always liked the kind of the opposite a little bit. You know, I liked the Brett. And I liked guys, you know, the Tiger Masks and,
yeah,
you know, people like that. And I think Eddie is my, that's why he always was like the ultimate guy for me, because he's sort of like the meeting point between the two.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he didn't have a lot of fire when he was younger. I think that's what drew me to him early in his career, because he was always kind of shy and quiet. You know, people, if you've been watching wrestling long enough, people forget like how quiet and smooth Eddie was. And he wasn't really the most charismatic guy in the beginning. Then later he became super fiery and was more of a fighter. So he kind of became the model for me at a certain point. Like, that's how you put the two together. But I do think that I've gotten a little better in my age, I guess.
Do you go back and watch, like, your old stuff?
You know, I try not to watch any of my stuff, really. But
really?
Occasionally, I'll... yeah, I don't, like... Johnny Depp once said about his movies, once I do them, they're out there, that belongs to other people. That's mm-hmm. other people's business now. And it's just on to the next one. I'll watch sometimes. I used to review some of my stuff with Shawn Michaels, at the PC. Like, mm-hmm. he was like kind enough to sit with me one-on-one, him and Terry Taylor. And we would occasionally watch my stuff from that week, like game study, like the NFL players would do or something like that, you know? But I generally, like, on my own time, I try not to watch. I'm not a big fan of myself. I don't really like I like watching other guys. So I don't really like watching myself, but I do notice differences in what I do. And I think mostly it's like the decision-making is, it became a lot more clear to me. Like, I don't know.
So when
that
you say decision making, like in moves and matches and like calling out and understanding where to go, things like that.
Yeah. Tempo changes, things like that. And like different reads you're making. Like, I was a kind of a classically trained guy. Like, I try to do more of it in the ring than I do in the locker room, so to speak. So, in approaching it that way, it's a life experience game. And I think that's really what the relevance to what Cody said is, and I used to hear that all the time, you don't hit your prime until your mid-30s. So I didn't really know what that meant. And now I kind of see that, you know, this game is much more geared towards your mental aptitude than it is your physical aptitude. And your meeting point of that for most people is in your 30s. You know, you're still at, you know, peak condition or close to it, like your body's ability to do things hasn't faded too much, but like your mental aptitude is much sharper than most people when they're in their mid-20s as opposed to, you know, your mid-30s. And obviously you get smarter as you get older, but your body starts to go the other direction. So this is usually the five-year window where they're kind of both near their peak. And I think that's kind of what makes it easy for me now. Because, you know, it does feel a lot more automatic now.
You can tell.
I don't work as hard as I used to do. I don't work as hard as I used to do when I was in my 20s. Like, I used to train a lot harder and different things. But now I think I feel like I see the angles and the different, you know, things that I need to make sure sharp. So it kind of narrows it down, frees up your mind to worry about other parts of the game. So I guess, you know, you maximize it better that way.
Do you think about when you get older in your 40s and what your style, how your style works, like how you'll have to continue to evolve? Do you think about that a lot as you're just thinking about the second half of your career?
Shit, man, I thought about that when I was 15 years old. I always knew that, you know, when I started when I was younger, it was not lost on me that a lot of guys do this until they're, you know, 50. And in order to do that, they have to be able to physically be able to do that. And, you know, a lot of the things that scares guys from starting is seeing how guys at that age struggle and their quality of life. And so, you know, for me, that's never been lost on me, because it's like, all right, I'm not scared enough of that to not do this since I'm starting. But in order to get there, like, I think people sometimes they forget, like, when I started at 13, yes, it's an advantage, but in that sort of way, it's almost like a disadvantage, because to me, now I'm looking at age 50. If I'm trying to do this and make money and make a career to age 50, I have twice as long to go now. Like, how do I take care of myself for that long? Like, if you start at 25 and then you really kind of get rolling at age 30, that's way, way, way shorter. So for me, I was always scared of that. Like, how am I possibly going to do it for that long? And so that's why I really kind of took up technical wrestling from the beginning, is just because I was like, you know, this is...
There's more staying
power
there.
Yes. It's like watching a basketball player who learns how to post up on a guy. Like, now they don't have to always drive through and like dunk on people. They don't always have to play this game where they have to be stronger or faster. They're just, their footwork is going to do it for them. They're learning to use the basket to their advantage, you know? So you see a lot of guys age more gracefully when they take up that sort of thing in basketball. So to me, that's what technical wrestling was, is like, this is how I can use the more delicate parts of the game to tell my stories. And, you know, the other good thing is, like, then people you work with, you get in the ring with, they enjoy their time with you more, because you're not killing them. So it's like, that helps me a lot, because then, you know, people are a lot more agreeable and easy to get in and out of the ring with in that way.
What is the hardest thing about transitioning from being a singles worker to a tag team worker? Because usually people go from tag team to singles, but you went back to tag teams for a little bit with Ba these past couple of years in Impact. Like, what did you have to kind of like retrain your wrestling brain a little bit to work as a team again?
So in some ways, yes. In some ways, no. I think the one thing that really was a big thing for me, because I've always been sort of, I guess, so like fans even know this term, like the idea of like a ring general, right? And I've always been somebody that kind of drove the boat, like whenever I'm working. And I don't know why that is. Like, it's not something I ever really asked to do. Obviously, from the beginning, I knew I was going to be a lifer in wrestling, so I wanted to learn how to be that good at it from an IQ standpoint. But from an early age, people would always kind of turn over the keys to me. So I don't know why, like something about me, like people expect me to kind of lead the dance, but that's always been that way. And then as I got older, I got really good at it. And now that's usually the role I'm in. And so for me, that was the biggest thing, is because when you're in a singles match, you have your hands on the wheel. So when you're adjusting the tempo and you're calling plays and all that sort of thing, I'm using these sports analogies just to help, you know, people kind of quickly understand like what it's like to be in that shoes, like without necessarily being a wrestler, but it's kind of like running the 2-minute offense as Tom Brady, right?
Yeah.
I have my hands on the ball. I'm reading the defense. I can tell everybody what I'm feeling, where we should go, but I'm also executing it. Whereas in a tag team match, I'm spending half that match trying to make those same calls, but I don't have my hands on the ball. So it's kind of like running the 2-minute offense as a running back at that point, or like a wide receiver. So you kind of can make the same reads, but it's hard to make sure everybody's going to be on the same page. So it's a little bit more challenging.
Yeah. It does seem like everything I read, that tag team wrestling is more challenging as a whole for a lot of guys than singles work. For you, do you think it's been difficult to juggle multiple gimmicks? How does that work when you're thinking about, like, this character is this character is this. Let me make sure I have a firm understanding and I'm able to bounce between the two. Because I always wondered that with you.
I mean, I have a lot of fun with it. I don't, like I was saying before with, like, tape study, I'm not a big fan of myself, like, just as is. Like, if I was a wrestling fan, I don't know that I would be my favorite wrestler or anything, which is weird because I, as myself, obviously I'm trying to pick and express stuff that I'm into, my style, the colors, you know, the things I'll choose to say in promos and stuff like that. But I don't particularly find myself that interesting. So I have a lot of fun with characters because then I could sort of branch out into other stuff artistically and then, you know, just explore other things that do entertain me, you know, and there's probably kind of almost a dozen different characters I've played, and they're all different in some sort of way. Sadistico, for example, from Lucha Libre USA, yeah. That project from MTV a while back. Like I was, it was almost like Darby Allin, basically. I played this like psycho skater luchador from Seattle. And I was like, yeah, this is kind of cool. I grew up in an era in like the late 80s and 90s with like grunge rock, and skating was like getting pretty big and mainstream. And I was like, I can play this. And it was kind of cool to play that sort of character. And El Bombero is a stripper fireman for Lucha Vivoom. And I'm like, yeah, this is cool. I loved, you know, Hector Garza, and Shawn Michaels is like my favorite wrestler. So I'm like able to sort of be the life of the party, so to speak, and stuff that isn't necessarily me. It's just stuff that entertains me. And then, you know, everything's different. Puma, Manic, Suicide, all of them. So.
Awesome. Well, we're running low on time, so I want to get through these pretty quickly with you. Are you ready for a rapid fire real quick, TJ?
Absolutely. Yeah.
All right.
Fire away.
I had in my notes and watching, I went back and watched your match with Chris Bay in December 15th. I think you and Chris Bay have the best in-ring chemistry in Impact Wrestling. Do you agree?
I definitely think it's up there. He's one of the few, not even just in Impact, but outside of Impact too. Like overall, he's one of the best I've ever been in the ring with.
I like it. He's going to be a thing. Chris Bay is going to be a top guy down the road. TJP or Manic is the Impact World Champion in 4 years or less. True or false?
I'm sorry. Say that. So TJP / Manic Mo Me,
yes,
is the I see that as X Division champion in 4 years or less.
No. Not X Division. World champion. Impact World champion.
Oh, sorry. World champion. Oh, okay. Sorry. I misheard you. I was still thinking about how good Chris Bay is.
He follows me on Twitter, so he's gonna like that. He's gonna like that. You're a big fan. There you go.
I am. He knows it too. Rapid fire to answer that. I'm going to say yes, only because if I can't do it within that, then I'm not, I'll never do it. So I'm going to set the bar and say yes. Yes. In 4 years or less, I better do it or else I need to find something else to do.
All right. Well, I'll do my best to prop you up. I'll do my best. I'll work the cards. I'll work the dirt sheets.
thank you.
Something wrestling fans don't know or don't see when it comes to in-ring psychology that you think will be fun to note.
Oh God. Wrestling fans don't know that we can see their emotions before they show them their emotion, before they show us their emotions.
Okay.
The good ones, like the guys in my position that are the best at what we do, we can see it before they show it. It's like X-ray vision in a poker game.
Interesting. I like it. Your favorite match that you had in the last year was what?
Ooh, Emergence, maybe. Triple threat.
I like that. That's a good one. That's a good pick. Your favorite wrestler to watch, because you don't watch yourself. Who do you enjoy watching the most right now?
Right now, the Great Muta. I'm going back and watching some old stuff from the Great Muta. Overall, it would be Eddie.
Okay. And last thing, the weirdest thing you found yourself doing with all the free time you've had in the last year. What is it, TJ?
I wish I had free time. I'm almost busier now with the different content I got to come up with because of shifting schedules. But I would say probably I've become pretty fond of stick handling in my living room.
Okay.
I always played ice hockey when I was younger, and I haven't been able to play a lot. And whenever I have some downtime, I pull out my practice ball and dangle a little bit, I guess is a hockey term. I randomly play hockey by myself in my living room.
Okay, I like it. The more you know. Well, TJ, yeah. this has been great. I've taken way too much of your time today, but I appreciate it. We can check out all your work on Tuesday nights on Access TV on Impact Wrestling. Things are going really great there. I'm really excited for you guys. Tune in. It is Tuesday as we're recording, so we'll be on tonight. Are you on tonight's show?
I'm not sure what the whole lineup is. God, a lot of having Kenny Omega on the show means stuff gets moved around for the big guy. So, but I think I will be on in some form or another. The X Division title is becoming a bigger and bigger part of Hard to Kill, so which is coming up on Saturday. So everybody, you know, who's listening, you know, if you can catch it. Fight TV, Impact Plus, all the platforms that you would usually catch it on.
Absolutely. Go do that. I'll be watching. TJ, keep up the great work, sir, and thank you for the time.
Thank you very much for having me.
All right, guys, we are good. I hope it did not take too much of your time, TJ.
No, not at all. It was my pleasure. Sorry, some of those questions are fun to answer, so I'll get going on it and then lose my mind.
No, that's good. That means I'm doing a good job, I guess.
No, it was one of the easiest interviews ever. I appreciate it. Thank you so much.
Absolutely, absolutely. Well, I hope 2021 is a great year for you, sir, and stay safe out there and stay healthy. And yeah, man, and keep up the great work. And I'm going to enjoy watching you from afar.
Hey, likewise. Thank you so much.
Nicely done, nephew. Chase Thomas Podcast. Hell yeah.
Sugar Ray Leonard, Roberto Duran, Marvelous Marvin Hagler, and Thomas Hearns. Legends, whose four-way rivalry defined one of the greatest eras in boxing history. Relive their decade of dominance in the new Showtime sports documentary, The Kings, a four-part series premiering Sunday, June 6th, only on Showtime.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market. it, mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. The future isn't scary. Not realizing its potential, however, could be. Just like on the recruiting trail, I've seen potential come in many forms as a coach. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.